The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Paris is a city beloved by the world. Since its redesign by Georges Eugène Haussmann in the 19th century, its wide boulevards, its magnificent buildings, its beautiful gardens and parks, its eccentricities like the Eiffel Tower have never lost their charm. Remarkably, while other cities around Europe were destroyed by bombing and fire in World War II, Paris remained essentially intact during and after attack and occupation by the Nazis. But it might have been otherwise. A brilliant new book from historian Patrick Bishop is entitled Paris 44, subtitled The Shame and the Glory. It looks behind the mythology of the occupation and liberation of Paris in a narrative driven by the stories of ordinary people, and some extraordinary, caught up in stirring and dangerous times. Patrick Bishop, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Great to be on the show.
Now, the title of your book is Paris 44, but what interests me in the wake of the Olympics is the Paris 44 that you write about is still very much the Paris of today, the landscape unchanged virtually.
That's absolutely right. I mean, anyone who had been alive in 1944 revisiting Paris now would be, I think, very pleasantly surprised to see that very little has changed. I mean, compared with the townscapes of London or Warsaw. I was in Warsaw a couple of days ago. You know, that was pretty much razed to the ground, but Paris survived pretty much unscathed.
Now, you talk about 44, which is the subject of the book, the shame and the glory, both intertwined, but you also start a little bit earlier, and the years between the First World War and the Second World War were years of almost waiting for another war to happen.
Yeah, I think most historians would agree that the First World War never really ended. There was a kind of breathing space, if you like, which both kind of blocks caught their breath and then resumed with renewed vigor, just over 20 years later. So, yeah, it's very much a continuous story. But, of course, what happens in between the wars is that political tensions in France in particular get particularly acute. So you've got a very divided society. And I think people reading the book will hear some echoes of those days in what's happening in France today, where, you've got, political divisions between left and right, which teeter on the brink sometimes of civil disorder.
Now, we know that Hitler had ambitions for Paris from the very beginning. Do you know where Hitler's fascination with Paris came from?
Well, as a young man, of course, he had artistic and architectural ambitions. And so, he was a sort of self-taught architect, if you like. He fancied himself as a sort of great town planner. And so, Paris would have been very much a model for him. And so, interestingly, when he's sort of making his plans for the new Berlin, he looks to Paris as a sort of template, but he's not satisfied with Paris. He wants everything to be bigger and better. So, the way it's laid out, it's very grandiose, triumphal sort of vibe that the whole place has. He wants to do that in Berlin, but bigger and better. But he's got affection for the place. His favorite building is the Opera Garnier, which I'm sure most people listening have been to Paris and they will have noticed this kind of wedding cake type, to my eyes, a bit of a monstrosity in the middle of Paris. But it's very ornamented, very sort of fussy. But he thought this was great. And so on this famous trip he makes to Paris, it's one of the very few times he actually leaves Germany, he takes his artistic friends with him, his architect friends, and they do this lightning tour of the monuments. And the first one they go to is the opera, and he enthuses about it and shows off his really very deep knowledge of all the nooks and crannies of the place, even correcting the guy that's showing them around. He shows how well he knows the plans by pointing to a room that should be there that isn't, and is delighted when he's told, no, you're absolutely right, sir, that was removed in a renovation some years ago. So, yeah, Paris had a place in his heart. But, of course, Hitler being Hitler, when things turn nasty, he's quite prepared to blow it up.
And we'll talk about that in a little while. But he wanted to fashion Berlin, as you say, in the model of Paris, a giant Arc de Triomphe. But then, perhaps, when he had rebuilt Berlin in this fashion, he might well have destroyed Paris.
Yes, because I think his thinking was, well, now we've got this Berlin, Paris is just a sort of, pale shadow of this new Berlin, which of course was never built in the end. So then he's sort of pretty indifferent to it. So when the time comes and things are going badly for the Germans after the Battle of Normandy, he tells the new military governor, turn the whole place into a fortress and blow it up if necessary.
Which it didn't happen in the end. And again, there's another story there. Paris, when you talk about the shame and the glory, the first shame of Paris is that it fell without resistance, really.
That's right. I think that was a very big dramatic psychological blow to everyone in France. Only in 1914, not that long ago, well within living memory, the French armies had stopped the Germans at the gates of Paris, literally on the Battle of the Marne. And then, 1940, they basically just stand back and let the Germans march in unopposed. Not a single shot is fired. So that was a source of great humiliation and a great shame, consequently, for the French. And I think that really colours the way they deal with the next 4 years, the 4 years of German occupation.
Now, you tell your story through the characters and the people, your pages. I mean, I mentioned the shame, and there's a guy you feature called Jacques Delmas, who heard the voice of de Gaulle on the radio from London, went to Paris, and saw Germans everywhere strolling up and down the boulevards, and he felt that Paris had been morally disemboweled.
Yeah, that's a great phrase, isn't it, Pat? And he says it's like someone coming into your house, eating your food, drinking your wine, smoking your cigars, and then acting as if it's sort of, completely their right. And I think a lot of people felt that. So yeah, there's a sense that why are we standing back and just letting them do that? But the question is, how do you react? You're powerless. And I think when we're looking at the way that the Parisians and the French in general behaved under the occupation, we should be very careful not to sort of take the moral high ground and say, oh, we would never have done that. This is something you hear in Britain or used to hear in Britain. But my view has always been, we don't know. Well, thank God it never happened to us. But looking at the sort of social composition of and political composition of Britain in 1940, my feeling is there'd be plenty of people who would be prepared to do a deal with the Germans, to accept occupation and to basically collaborate in pretty much the same way as a lot of French people did.
Now, Paris was intact, so for the occupiers, almost like a holiday camp, a pleasure palace for 20,000 Germans. They got some sort of a welcome. I mean, the brothel keepers, the hoteliers, the restaurant owners did serve the Germans.
Yeah, they didn't miss a beat. In the cabarets and the nightclubs and the dance halls and et cetera. The performers that had really kind of in some ways been characterized Frenchness before the war, like Maurice Chevalier, Charles Trenet, Edith Piaf, they were sort of back on stage pretty well instantly and now playing to audiences of men in grey uniforms. So the same as you say went for the restaurateurs and the hoteliers and the brothel keepers. I mean, the business boomed under the occupation.
And
But
it wasn't
that's
only
been.
the professional women who fell to the charms of the German occupiers. In your book, you suggest that as many as 80,000 babies might have been born to German fathers.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I don't really, again, feel that there's anything particularly terrible about that. I mean, there's a great British historian, Richard Cobb, who said that in a way, the baby born of the occupier and the occupied is a sort of symbol of humanity, and that this is like how people, ordinary people, get on with life. People fall in love. It wasn't. These were some of the women bearing babies were prostitutes, but a lot of them were just women who happened to fall in love with a German. And of course, they suffered terribly at the end of the war, and of the French War in 1944, after liberation. There's this épuration, this kind of cleansing, where the first victims are these women. They're these so-called practitioners of collaboration horizontale. So they're women basically who'd slept with Germans, and they're tarred and feathered, and they have their heads shaved. And there's a kind of orgy of retribution, which looks very ugly now when you see the pictures of these poor women surrounded usually by men, jeering men, who haven't actually got very much to be proud about during their period. under German rule.
Now, there are stories that intertwine. There's the story of Paul Rosenberg, an art collector who departs for the United States and leaves some of his art behind, manages to salvage quite a proportion of it, but also leaves a son behind to serve, and a woman called Rose Vallon, whose story intersects with their story in the sense that she is a mole, a spy, logging all the arts and artifacts that the Germans were looting and ensuring that they could be found.
Yeah, this is a great story. I mean, it's known in France, but it's not much known here. Rose Vallon was a sort of scholarly lady who worked in one of the big art galleries in the Jeu de Paume as a volunteer, actually, not on the staff there. And when the Germans arrive and start basically stealing everything they can lay their hands on of the art treasures of France, on the instructions of Goering, Field Marshal Goering, who wants them for his own collection, there's also a big plan to have a Hitler art museum in Austria. So all the kind of traditional works are going off to those two places, and the modern works are sent off to Switzerland to be flogged on the art market there to raise funds for this museum. But Rose, quiet, unassuming Rose, she speaks German, but she doesn't let on that. She carries on with her work there. And all the looted art is put in this in the Jeu de Paume for storage. And everything that goes in and out is quietly noting it all, photographing it in some cases. So when the liberation comes, they've got a record, not only of what's been stolen, but you know where it was sent off to, which is a brilliant, brilliant act of resistance. So her story looms large in that. And just as a coda to that, Paul Rosenberg was one of those whose art was stolen. And his son comes back to France as a fighting soldier with the French Free French Deuxième Blindé Division. And by pure fluke, he's sent off to intercept this train, which is leaving Paris with a group of men, and they stop it and they open it up. And there is a lot of his father's looted artwork. So it's a brilliant sort of circular story.
Now, the situation right throughout the period of occupation, for periods it was peaceful, but the resistance got going, and that led immediately to reprisal. The killing of Alphonse Moser on the metro in August of 1942 began a cycle of violence.
That's right. It's the shooting really begins with that assassination of Moser, who was actually not a significant figure at all, but he looked as if he was important in his smart uniform. And the person that pulled the trigger was a communist. We've got to remember that's very important, because the communists had laid low until then because of the Hitler-Stalin pact. And Moscow was telling the French communist, don't do anything. Indeed, the German soldier is your friend. He's a fellow proletarian like you. So if you see him in the bar, buy him a drink. Well, after Hitler invades Russia in June 1941, that changes. And the message now is, if you see a German soldier, shoot him. So it's a complete volte-face, rather a cynical one. But the communists turn out to be the best resistance fighters. Even though they're communists, they're also French men and French women. They're pretty patriotic. So it was a great relief, I think, to most of the rank and file when the change came about. So they basically lead the charge in the gathering resistance as they get more arms, they get better tactics, etc. So by early 1944, they're causing the Germans not huge military problems, but life's become very different in Paris if you're one of the troops there, one of the German troops there. Whereas before you could swan around and feel as if you were kind of almost welcome, now you know that everyone really hates you.
Now, the relationship between the Vichy government of Marshal Pétain and the Germans, I mean, what sort of relationship was that?
It's a complicated one to start off with. I mean, you've got to remember, Pétain was a great French hero, a great military hero, the victor of Verdun. So in 1916, you know, he was credited with stopping the Germans at Verdun, a terrible bloody battle. But by 1940, he's an old man. He's kind of disillusioned, he's tired, and he's defeatist. So he actually is pressing for an armistice. He wants the war to end. And he says, OK, henceforth, there'll be no more democracy. I'm in charge, and I'm staying here. Not like de Gaulle, who's run away. De Gaulle was presented as a sort of traitor and a villain. I'm staying here to protect you from the Germans. Now, the Germans sort of play along and give him what appears to be a degree of autonomy. There's a pretense that there's still a sort of proper French state that has some control over its own destiny. But it's all a fiction. Basically, the Germans just take everything they want from France in terms of resources and indeed manpower. And Pétain carries on pretending that this is a sort of partnership of almost equals, when in fact he's just a sort of stooge that allows the Germans to do what they want.
And he died in prison for his troubles a few years after the war. Now, the liberation of Paris, it came, obviously, the Allies with the Americans approaching, and the end was nigh, and the instructions, it seems, from Hitler were destroy the city. It didn't happen, and the man who might have ordered the bombing of the city and the explosions and the bridges and the buildings and so on tried to make himself out to be a bit of a hero.
Yeah, he did so pretty successfully. I mean, that phrase people will remember is Paris Burning. That was the title of his one of his autobiographies. He wrote several accounts of his time there. And that's a phone call he's meant to have received from Hitler asking him, have you carried out my orders? Have you blown up Paris? It's all very hazy. There's no record of this phone call ever being made. But Choltitz was a slippery character. He was a thoroughgoing Hitler fan at the beginning of the war. But as things turned nasty, he decided, like a lot of senior commanders, OK, we've got to get rid of this guy. But he still wants to stay alive. The bomb plot has just happened. And so a lot of his fellow officers are being strung up by the SS. So he's got to play a very, very delicate game. He wants to stay alive. He wants to appear to be obeying Hitler's orders. But at the same time, he knows that Paris is going to fall pretty soon. And he wants to make himself out to be a sort of humanitarian who has saved the city of light for the world. So very slippery customer. And most of his claims, I think you've got to be taken with a huge pinch of salt. So I don't think he really was the man who saved Paris.
But Hitler would have, if he could, have destroyed Paris. He ordered V1 rockets to be pointed at fired at London, at Paris, but all the platforms of the V1s in Calais were actually aimed at London and could not be diverted.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that, Pat, because that's a really interesting story, which I don't think many people realize. So even though the Allies took the city, there was still a chance it was going to be bombarded by these very effective rockets, which would be firing at fairly close range. But thanks to that sort of quirk of positioning, it meant that although a few fell in the suburbs, Paris, again, as we said at the beginning, remained pretty intact.
Now, the book is full of characters, people we know, like Ernest Hemingway, J.D. Salinger, Jerry, as he is called in the book, Picasso, who found the whole occupation of Paris a bit troublesome, really, in interfering with his domestic arrangements with his women, Sylvia Beach, the publisher of James Joyce. All of these characters feature. But perhaps one of the most extraordinary characters who's offset, as it were, for most of the book is Charles de Gaulle and his entry into Paris. An act of bravery, you say?
Yeah, well, he was extraordinarily courageous. But the funny thing is that de Gaulle didn't take a great deal of interest in the resistance for the first years of the war, because his real work was trying to persuade the British and most of all the Americans to take him seriously as the embodiment of France in exile. And so all his energies really went into that. He let the resistance get on with themselves. And so their main value to him was to be able to say, look, France hasn't ever really accepted defeat. Look, we've got this resistance. But he didn't really bother with the fine details until the very end. But once the moment came, he seized it with brilliant skill. So he basically just arrives in France and says, I'm here now. The resistance is, it was great. Thanks a lot, guys. But now I'm in charge. And he did it very effectively. He was really just a voice on the radio to most people. No one even knew what he looked like. So when he turns up in Paris on the 25th, on the day of liberation, this is the first time anyone's really seen him or seen him what he looks like. And he looks pretty impressive. He's a very tall man by French standards. He's at least a head taller, in some cases a foot taller than most of the people who surround him when he arrives at the Hotel de Ville to sort of claim his kingdom, if you like. So brilliant coup de théâtre. And of course, He also then starts building this myth that Paris liberated itself, that the French army really did the job, and that this was a great moment in French history.
And the scenes you describe as he heads towards Notre Dame and machine gun fire erupting from the rooftops around him, and he doesn't flinch, not for a second.
No, and this impresses everyone around him. There's a great BBC radio report. You can get it on YouTube if you Google it, of this chap, you know, describing in real time the reporter of De Gaulle marching in, the gunfire. You can hear the gunfire. And saying, "This is, I've never seen such bravery," he says. Sort of, De Gaulle just acts as if absolutely nothing is happening. And this happens several times in the course of that day. This is, of course, the 26th, the day after the liberation.
Well, Patrick, it's a fabulous book. Paris 44, it's called, subtitled The Shame and the Glory. It's published by Viking. It's available everywhere in handsome hardback. And Patrick Bishop, its author, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.